This week, we speak to one of North America's biggest players in publishing, and we discuss Adam Sandow's secrets of success in the business. Plus, an interview with a renowned Colombian author, also editor-in-chief of Gato Pardo, monthly lifestyle title from Mexico. A couple of veritable print prodigies holding court today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up on the programme, we'll hear from Felipe Restrepo Pombo, Colombian author and journalist, currently editor-in-chief of respected Mexican monthly Gato Pardo. But we start the show speaking to the chairman and CEO of Sandow. The publishing side of the company owns a selection of magazine titles like Interior Design, Worth and New Beauty. That chairman and CEO is Adam Sandow, and he joins us now. Adam, great to speak with you. Thanks very much for joining us on The Stack. Let's start with your story, I guess, back at the beginning, the origins, if you like, of your long and successful life in print. I gather you were something of a print prodigy.
I was. My parents were in the printing business, so I grew up around printing presses and fell in love with computers back in the early days. And right in high school, actually started a graphic design company. And quickly that design company kind of quickly turned into a media business, started to really fall in love with not only design, but more importantly, the printed word. Started creating custom publishing for other people and building magazines for companies like airlines and hotels, and really got my feet wet in the business very early, like my freshman year of college early.
And that's pretty unusual, I guess. To what degree do the same kind of principles that were driving you right back at that stage, do they still drive you now? I mean, clearly, you know, the scaling of everything is completely different. The responsibility you have, the breadth of the stable of titles you have now, for example, is so different. But are there certain fundamentals you come back to which maybe are the same as they were in those early days?
You know, they do. I mean, my love of design, my eye for design has only grown. But more importantly than that, from my earliest days launching my very first real magazine, there was always an idea that we had to do something more. We had to be innovators. Even back in the days when magazines were in their golden age and you know, a successful kind of standard magazine could be a great business, we always looked at ways we could innovate, whether it was our distribution platforms or the services we sell. Innovation has played, I would say, the most important part in building this company, especially as we sit today. It's really come from thinking very, very differently than I would say traditional magazine publishers were thinking back in those days, and certainly today as well.
Well, to that point, Adam, is there something interesting there? Often we hear about traditional values and people talk about heritage print brands, and they talk about that often pejoratively. And there's a sort of implicit suggestion that you can't innovate if you value the traditional way of doing things or traditional values. I mean, I sense from the work you've done throughout your career that you would beg to differ with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the magazine industry itself certainly continues to change. I'm one that, as a very large content producer, I don't think that it's just about converting print to digital. I think you've got to do a lot more. And that thinking was evident even in our earliest days. One of the first big magazines that I launched in 2005 was called New Beauty. And it was designed as a kind of the authority in all things beauty for women. And it was a very, very smart magazine, and still is today, very, very successful business. And the strategy we took was everything from a very, very high cover price of $10 back in 2005. No one had even thought of anything at that price. But the thinking in that magazine, for example, was taking us down some very interesting roads. We invented it back in 07. We were the first ones, the very first, to invent the beauty sampling business, which today there's so many of them globally. But back in 07, no one had thought of that. No one had come up with the idea of charging readers to actually be able to be the first to try new products in sample form. We built that business in 07, and frankly, that business has generated probably more profit dollars over the last decade than even the print business. But thinking differently like that and getting into different types of businesses in and around the media platform allowed us to maintain our integrity of the brand. It allowed us to serve our readers, but it also allowed us to get into other businesses that, especially back then, would be kind of tough to just launch out of nowhere without the backing of a very powerful, credible media vehicle.
Well, yeah, and you've given us a good sort of overview of another aspect of your, I guess, a sort of prevailing business plan, which I actually wanted to ask you about. And that was exactly that point about diversifying, but not necessarily, as you say, just trying to bridge the gap between, say, print and digital, but looking at it more holistically. You've dabbled in things like, you know, looking at newsstand networks. And so often when I talk to really interesting publishers on this program, they sort of rail, oh, you know, this is where it all falls down. You can be doing the best work in the business, but then the distribution models aren't there. Do you think that your business savvy and that inquisitiveness about innovating in spaces like that and in these completely other parts of business, has that been at least equally important as your love, as you said, for graphic design and for print in the hand and this sort of thing?
It certainly has. You know, when I launched in the early days our early magazines, we always had a strategy of highest quality, most expensive price on newsstand. And I saw the newsstand, again, this is now going back, and still today, I saw the newsstand as a place to find very, very engaged readers. I believed that especially in the United States, the highly discounted subscription business is one of the biggest culprits eroding the magazine business today in the United States, because the magazines are virtually given away for almost nothing in a subscription. And what that's done is it's eroded the newsstand. I know in Europe, it's a little bit of a different thought. So I saw the magazine buyer, the newsstand buyer, paying a premium for a printed product as something that was critical. But we took that thinking even further in kind of later, 2008, 2009, 2010. And what we did is we actually built our own network of newsstands in private airports. I saw that with, you know, coming out of the recession, private aviation in the United States, certainly, and globally, became one of the greatest single places to reach ultra-affluent readers and to actually capture their attention. So we started buying all the rights to newsstands in private airports, and we built our own network. Today we have close to 300 locations. And those locations serve not only as a valuable business as one of my companies, but as one of our secret weapons across all of my media companies, where the access to arguably the wealthiest people on the planet by the tens and tens of thousands per month, it puts our magazines in the hands of some very important people, and it creates, again, very highly engaged relationships, only with a very desirable crowd. So again, thinking, you're a magazine publisher with subscriptions and with newsstand distribution, and then making the jump to building our own distribution business and kind of owning the rights to these very valuable locations. You know, we've been doing this now 10 years. It's one of those things that, again, has helped me build a successful business that thinks differently about the printed product and about the services we offer our advertisers and partners.
Indeed. And I wanted to ask you more about that breadth of offer. We often, Adam, try and sort of spread a bunch of the titles that the people I'm talking to out on the desk. I'm going to need to get a bigger desk, and I've only got but a handful here. Tell us a bit about that family. I mean, I won't ask you the obvious questions like which is your favorite, because that's like choosing favorite children. But what matters most to you? Is it titles like New Beauty that have been on this really great journey with you? Is it more recent creations or additions where there's that freshness? How do you sort of balance out your time across this really mixed portfolio?
My time is spent focusing purely on what's next. So we've got incredible leaders in the company that run the various divisions and the various magazines. For example, Interior Design Magazine, which is now 86 years old and is usually regarded as the Bible of interior design, both commercial and residential. Today, that business is so diversified, whether it's into conferences and events or licensing or even data and research. But where I focus my time is looking at these businesses and saying, what are the tools and services that I can build on top of the media? And this goes across my whole company and my philosophy as a media entrepreneur. I look at the foundation that I have, and I'm fortunate in what we've been able to build. Today, we, by revenue, are the largest publisher of design magazines in the United States by revenue. We look at the portfolio we've been able to build, and I spend my time, unlike I think most publishers, where they're looking and saying, what are the events we can do? What are the digital places we can go? I spend my time saying, what are the entirely new tools and services that I can build on top of that media platform, very much the way that I built and invented the beauty sampling business for the beauty industry on top of a very successful beauty magazine. As we look, I spend my time focusing on what are those next generation things we can build that in reality have potential to become much bigger than the media companies themselves. But owning the media platforms gives us an advantage that you just couldn't get without owning this kind of these kinds of media platforms. And that's where I spend my time. It's what I enjoy most. It's our biggest challenges, and some of the new businesses that we're building now are incredibly exciting and very much technology driven, but they're built on that foundation of media that would be hard to duplicate without having those media assets. And I think that's the secret for not only what we're doing, but for every media publisher out there. I think that's how they have to think in order to be successful long-term.
Absolutely. And in terms of successes, maybe we can just zero in a little on some of the specific titles and how they're performing. Just give us a quick sort of précis, if you can, Adam, of what's doing particularly well on Newsstand. Obviously, we know there's a narrative of contractions in sales, whether that's in newspapers or in magazines, on Newsstand or by subscription. How are your titles measuring up? Maybe you could give us a couple of examples of ones that are weathering that storm and performing particularly well.
A great example is Lux magazine. Lux is something that I started in 2005. Lux is something that, frankly, was a couple of $100,000 business in 2005. Today, Lux generates more revenue from the design industry and advertising than any design magazine in the United States. The secret to that business is the regionality. The fact is that when you build a magazine that caters to the design industry, regionality, especially in the United States, is critically important. Someone building a home in New York City versus the Hollywood Hills of Los Angeles is a very, very different aesthetic. So that business is something that is a little bit of an anomaly in that it continues its unprecedented ability to grow year over year over year. And I'm proud of it because we've worked really hard from an initial idea in 05 to what it is today. We've never had a down year. Not even in the recession have we had a down year. That again goes back to the way in which we designed that magazine, which was very much a regional business overlaid with a very strong national business. That's allowed us to post growth in advertising, in print advertising. This is not, you know, declining print and growing digital. This is growth in print because we've really worked hard to try and connect with the affluent homeowners around the United States to use this as a tool, as a guide to further design and decorate their homes. So we're particularly proud of things like that that have been able to weather a storm where, you know, the industry is seeing double-digit year-over-year declines, which makes it always a challenging environment to be in, no matter who you are or how good you think your products are.
Indeed. It's funny, Adam, you speak with such sort of clarity and with such a sort of clear understanding of the big picture. It makes it sound so easy, and yet there aren't that many doing what you're doing. And to that point, perhaps we could maybe to close just get a sense from you about looking forward. I mean, you've already said explicitly how much your thoughts and focus is dominated by the next project. Given that, then, how do you retain that big strategic grasp with all these different things which are conflicting for time and presenting their own unique challenges? What's the secret? Is it just staying true? I guess we go right back to the beginning, to those sort of founding values that got you into this crazy business in the first place. How do you go about keeping that laser focus?
You know, I think that it's not only, you know, it's one, having a great team. I've been fortunate to build a great team of people around me that have been there to help in growing and doing all the things we do. But I think that I am truly blessed with kind of equal right brain, left brain, if you will, very, very creative and very analytical. And that's what I love. Nothing makes me happier than using kind of both sides of the brain at once and focusing on how do I think really, really differently? How do I use creativity and innovation, which are, you know, often overused words, but how do I use those two words to think very, very differently about our media businesses and what we can build on top of those media businesses? And having a great team allows me the the luxury of being able to spend the vast majority of my time traveling around the country and the world, working on all of these new exciting growth opportunities of our business that will continue to take us in more and more of new horizons, but never forgetting that they're built on that all-important foundation of, and credibility, frankly, of the media businesses that we own and love so much.
Indeed. It's been fantastic speaking with you, Adam. Inspirational stuff. Thanks so much for your time.
Are you fed up with the white noise that often passes for news coverage? Do you want something more than soundbite journalism when it comes to the big issues of the day? Then join Monocle's editors and guests for The View from Midori House. Informed analysis, serious debate, and lively discussion. Every weekday at 1800 London time, tune in to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Monocle has bureau around the world, in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Toronto, our bureau chief is Thomas Lewis.
Torontonians like to think of this place as one of the most diverse and one of the most tolerant anywhere in Canada, if not anywhere in the world. And the energy that brings off, I think, is really fertile ground for a journalist, a bureau chief, for Monocle as a whole to tap into and to play a key part in.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Let's head to the Hay Festival now, the prestigious literary event hosted in Wales. On the guest list this year was Colombian journalist Felipe Restrepo Pombo, acclaimed not only for his editorial nous, but also, appropriately for Hay, as a novelist. He's the editor-in-chief, too, of Mexico City-based Gato Pardo, a monthly lifestyle magazine and a pretty influential title across Latin America. Felipe started his career at news magazine Cambio under the direction of none other than the great Gabriel Garcia Marquez. He met Monocle's Georgina Godwin at Hay to talk about his career.
I was born in Colombia. I'm an author, an editor, and a journalist. I have been working for 20 years now in many fields of journalism and in writing. I started very young, at 19, at a magazine in Colombia called Cambio. And my first editor was Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And then I've been moving around the world, traveling, interviewing different people. I've published 3 nonfiction books. 2 of them are a collection of journalistic profiles. 3 years ago, I published a novel called The Art of Vanishing. And I was chosen as one of the best Latin American young writers under 40. And 4 years ago, I have been the editor-in-chief of a magazine in Mexico. It's called Gato Pardo.
Tell me about Gato Pardo. What is it?
Well, Gato Pardo is a very unique magazine in the Hispanic world because we run very long features of narrative journalism. We are an independent magazine. We don't belong to a big company. We work in Mexico City, but we are writing about Latin America and Latin Americans in the world, in the United States, in Europe, in Asia. So we have a long list of freelance writers that are continually sending us stories. We are a monthly magazine and we've been running for 18 years now, and we've won the important journalism awards. But what's most important about us, I think, we believe in long-form journalism, very narrative, very close to literature, and we really believe in going very deeply into the subjects we write about.
Mm-hmm. And what is your business plan?
We're expanding our readers all over the world, and obviously the way to do it is through the digital version of it. But we're very lucky to have luxury brands, advertisers that believe in us and that see us as a very interesting publication, so we're not into the danger of that many other magazines are nowadays in Latin America, especially where they're closing magazines every day. We're very lucky to be very supported by readers and by advertisers.
Mm-hmm. Who are your readers? What's the demographic and where's the magazine sold?
That is very complicated because you would think that our readers are a lot older than they actually are. We have very young readers that are literature or journalism students, but we also have a lot of well-educated readers that really enjoy the way we tell stories. So the demographics are very, very difficult to get because I like to think that we do a magazine that specialists can read, but also it's very up to a general public.
Mm-hmm. Just looking through the beautifully produced magazine and picking out a couple of things that you could find in a typical issue. So, for instance, in your latest issue, you have a thing about place in Colombia, which is a little like Venice.
Yeah, we love to find out these really strange stories that nobody else tells, and that's why we have people working, and that's why we have contributors all over the world looking for these unique stories. You know, we're talking about Mexico, about Latin America, but not necessarily through politics or through the obvious subjects. We like to think that in Latin America, of course, you have the problems and the things everybody knows about and that are reflected on everyday newspapers and television. But we want to tell the story of Latin America and Mexico through very different stories, and that also can tell you more about our continent. Of course, we write about that, but also we enjoy very much talking about people who are doing creative stuff, like writers, designers, artists. So we're very driven to talk about creativity.
Mm-hmm. What's the magazine market like in Latin America and Mexico?
It's complicated because our main market is in Mexico. Obviously, our print edition is mostly sold in Mexico throughout libraries, throughout department stores. We don't run an enormous quantity of magazines, but it's quite big for a country like Mexico. For me, it's very interesting every time I travel around the country or every time I travel to other countries in Latin America to see that we have readers everywhere. So that means that the magazine travels and the magazine has readers all over. So for me, it's very interesting to see that.
You have a couple of other roles too. I know that you're associated with Paris Match and also El País.
Yes, I've had the luck to be involved with very different medias around the world. I write a lot from a newspaper in Colombia called El Tiempo, but also I was invited to be a contributor to El País, which I think is one of the best Hispanic medias. In Paris, I had the enormous chance to be invited to be the international editor for Paris Match for a few months. And since then, I've been having a very good relation with them, and I try to be the correspondent when they want to write about Latin America or the United States. I help them, and I have a very good relation with them.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you were saying, your own magazine, Gato Pardo, isn't explicitly political, but presumably when you're writing for El País, you do stray into that territory. And of course, Mexico has elections coming up, and I wonder how you're planning to cover that.
Yes. Actually, I like, obviously, politics, and what I was saying is not that our magazine is not political, but we like to talk about politics from a different point of view. But I'm very interested in what's going on in Mexico. In fact, I was the editor of a book called The Sorrows of Mexico that was published in the United Kingdom with Maclehouse Press. Of course, we're having the elections next month, so what we decided to do is we wanted to have a series of documentaries. We plan them, we produce them, about the subjects that don't necessarily are talked about enough during an election campaign. Candidates are talking about, they're not talking about the real issues. So we decided to do this series of very short documentary pieces on poverty, on forced disappearance, on violence against women, on immigrants, and to go deep in those subjects, not like a candidate will do to get votes, but as a very independent perspective on those subjects.
We're having this conversation here at the Hay Festival in Wales, and Hay has had an outpost, if you like, in Mexico. And I know that several years ago, some of the writers there instigated a process whereby at the beginning of every session, people stood up and read the names of the Mexican journalists who had been disappeared. And I wonder how much is now still being done to protect journalists in Mexico and how real that problem is, and indeed, if you feel threatened yourself.
Well, as you know, Mexico is now the most dangerous place in the world, one of the most dangerous places in the world to be a journalist. We get colleagues kidnapped, threatened, censored every day. When the Hay started doing its festival first in Jalapa and then in Querétaro, where it's based now, we thought that it would be very important to mention what's going on with journalism and with free speech. Because when you have a festival like this, you have journalists coming and writers coming from all over the world, and the government there wants to show them a very nice and a very glamorous image of what goes on in the country. But the truth is that local journalists have a very difficult time, and in many, many zones of the country, they're not even allowed to go there. And if they go there, they're risking their own lives. And the state doesn't do anything to protect them. So I think it's very important. Every time I get to travel, I get to go to festivals. I like to talk about this because I think it's my responsibility to tell people, not to victimize anyone, but to tell the reality that's going on. So the Hay Festival has been very helpful to get this message in Mexico, but out of Mexico, and to have colleagues from all over, you know, not only journalists, writers, artists, to have a more critical point of view about what happens with the freedom of speech there.
And do you expect any meaningful change then after the election?
I don't. Sadly, I don't. I think either of the candidates who can win or who will win are not interested at all in changing the situation. They say they are, but the reality is that when they get to power, they forget everything they said in the campaign, and they will forget the terrible situation that journalism is going through. When I was editing this book, The Sorrows of Mexico, with the editors in the UK, Bill Swainson and Christopher Michaelhouse, we decided to do an appendix with just a list of the names of the journalists that have been attacked in the last years. And we had a very surprising result. It was a 20 long page list, just to give you the idea of what it means. So I think it is also very important to have a book like that published here in the UK, but also in France and in Australia, because people don't necessarily know that these kind of things happen.
That was Felipe Restrepo Pombo in conversation with Georgina Godwin. And that's all we have time for on this week's programme. Thanks to our producer, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our editor, Cassie Galpin. Comments, queries and suggestions are welcome as ever. Drop a line to Fernando. You'll find him on fp@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the same time next week. This is The Stack. My name's Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.